plank is going to be, well, let me just show you the outline of my talk. It's going to be some very selected aspects of the plank results, and I would like to spend a little more time talking about what comes after plank, because I think that with B-modes, there are some very exciting things ahead where we can really constrain inflation. So I would like to focus on giving more details. I think most of you have read many of the plank papers and are sort of aware of a lot of the issues. So I'll just show you a few things and make a few comments, and then spend the bulk of my talk on B-modes. So this, I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but this is actually one of the plots from the plank papers that has been reproduced the most and gotten the most attention. And if one looks at the plank inflation paper, I'm going to talk a little about some anomalies where I think the jury's still out, and we really don't know what to think. The first round of papers is sort of the state of the analysis when we were told, well, you will publish. But if you take apart the anomalies, the picture is very simple, and that there's a lot of the paper devoted to, you know, reconstructing the inflationary potential, and I think people were ready for something rather baroque. But here's the plot, and you can see that the allowed region is really quite large, and I don't think we really, I mean, what if we really accomplished? Well, the fact that one doesn't have scale at variance is a lot sharper, with a lot more significance, without relying so much on other data, but there's a sort of tendency for concave models, but it's not decisive. And the way I look at this plot is, well, the length of these you can argue about, because this is subject to uncertainties with reheating, or we call it entropy generation. But basically, this is the height of the potential. The first derivative basically gets determined by the amplitude of the perturbation, so it's just fit, not plotted. And then this is sort of the moral equivalent of the second derivative. And we don't really see a need for higher derivatives. So as Neil said in his summary, what is seen is consistent with a very simple picture. We've had talks at this conference with going from the very simple to you know, very complicated models with many functions. So this is the nature of theory, to look at all possible possibilities. So I won't really, let me just go to what might be a sort of wrinkle on this picture. So what we would hope for is, with the results, and it's, I think, not the way experiments work, is that either you get this sort of stunning confirmation of a sort of simple model, or there are these anomalies that are overwhelming and you really see something new. And unfortunately, there are many things to look for, and there are sort of many little things that don't quite seem to fit, but you don't really know what to think. So, I mean, that's a bit my view of the anomalies. And I don't think we can really tell people, oh, well, you should take this seriously, you shouldn't. Our job is to say what we did, and then you go off and think about it, and we'll see with future data. So with a power spectrum, basic approach, you know, the six-parameter model and its extension is to just sort of, well, expand in logarithms, and then with WMAP, you could just make the scale invariant, and there's one number. Here we need two numbers, and we tried, you know, is there any evidence for these others sort of in this framework? But you could do something else. You could just say, well, let's just use this as a base. And and so this is sort of your best fit spectrum. And then we're going to just look in a sort of agnostic way for wiggles. So if you just try to invert, there's just too much noise. So you have to do something like a penalized likelihood, and there are many different approaches, but they're all basically trying to smooth. Here, the sort of endpoints where there are no data are fixed. So this is what was done in the paper, but if you would do it by some of the other prescriptions, you would get more or less the same thing. And this is this was done before the data, so we put in little features here, Gaussians with different widths, and we ran tons of Monte Carlo simulations to make sure that both the error model was correct as far as we could best construct it, and that there was no bias in the reconstruction. So the details are in a paper cited before. And this is what the result is. So, well, these are the cosmological parameters. This doesn't really matter so much. And to some extent, these boxes is more a visual representation. So these red curves are the reconstructed power spectrum with a large degree of smoothing, less smoothing. And these little error boxes were chosen to be more or less not strongly correlated with each other. So they're not absolutely independent, but this is just to give you a visual feel. So you have one and two sigma. So here you can see that these two are sort of just right on pretty much with the expectation. Then when you get to less smoothing, you see sort of an oscillation here at the end. And here you see something that's basically the maximum excursions or 3.2 and 3.9. And then you these could have happened anywhere, and these things are correlated. So the way we dealt with this is we just did tons of Monte Carlo realizations and got the p-values. What is the chance of having something more extreme? And you got 2.4 sigma here for having an excursion that's more extreme, and 3.1 sigma. So in my opinion, and we looked a lot for mistakes and couldn't find anything, so this is what is in the paper. Okay, so what does this mean? Where does it come from? So, this is basically the primordial power spectrum, that it's basically a deconvolution of the power spectra that from the maps, and it's a cross spectrum. So this is from the Planck likelihood, and these are the different frequency channels after the foregrounds have been subtracted, et cetera. So first you notice this is a cross correlation. This is 100 megahertz. So Planck is diffraction limited, which means that as you go to the smaller and smaller angular scales, you're relying more and more on high frequencies, and you can't rely so much on linear combinations. So the thing you see right here, the black curve is the reconstruction, and the line here is if there were nothing, it would be just the best fit power law spectrum. And here in the 217 gigahertz, you see a dip at around 1800, and this is rather narrow, around 15%. So there's clearly, there's a what seemed to be a connection between here and what we saw in the previous plot. You see it somewhat in the cross correlation, but not as strongly. And then here, the error bars are too large. I mean, the beam smoothing is basically what sort of cuts off the information. So this is where it's coming from. And then we can also sort of verify this hypothesis by sort of making a caricature of what is seen in the power spectrum, running it through CAMP, and you get sort of a feature just like what you see. So whether this thing is real or not is basically a question of, do you believe this? So let's see. Arguments, what it could not be, various foregrounds, infrared galaxies, Sunyaev Saldovich, there's some clustering, et cetera. And those are part of the foreground model. So these are the things, these sort of colored curves. And what you notice is that they're all rather smooth polynomials. And so it's hard, maybe not completely impossible, if you play stuff against each other. But it's not very plausible to imagine that it's the foreground model. And then if you look, for example, at the ACT foreground paper, which goes way out to the right, because it has a much better angular resolution because of the mirror, you see that these basically the same foreground models match. So it's hard to imagine that the foregrounds would have such a narrow resonance and be able to explain this away. There are other things. There are questions of beams and all sorts of things, but I think for the time, one just has to wait for this is just the first year of data. There's not the full data. This hasn't been studied as much. I think one thing that'll be better in the future releases is one of the tests that's highlighted in the parameters paper is the overall chi-squared of the fit. And this is a very important test. This, if you've messed up your noise model, you will see excess chi-squared, but except when everything is combined, this is a little high. This is actually pretty good. But this is not the best way to look for residuals in new physics, because the thing to take away is look how many degrees of freedom there is. So you basically dilute any signal on, even with a resonance that's sort of delta L over L, around 15% in the noise. So you should expect to pass this test, but it's not really the most sensitive test of new physics. Yeah, it's a bit out there. But if you, let's see, if you have sort of underestimated the noise by a couple percent, then you can explain this. Well, you get excess variance. And, you know, if you go back to here, well, you know, if you stretch these error bars to a few percent, I'm not saying you shouldn't ask questions, but it responds to a sort of different, very legitimate question. If this were 3, well, we should worry. But these are all very reasonable, I think. What? I don't know. I think, I mean, you choose how many degrees of freedom you want the binning. I mean, what we do here with the power spectrum is we basically have here very few degrees of freedom. So if there were like a sort of camber, you would see it, and you got it. So then we put in more and more degrees of freedom gradually. So this is sort of the most sensitive test, and it would have been interesting to do the same in the parameters paper, and I'm sure with the one that will come out a year from now, one will have the same thing. Okay, well, I basically set up all of this. I'm going to have one slightly provocative slide because we spent a lot of time arguing about statistics and what should be believed. So this is one Bayesian point of view. And so I took this from the Wikipedia article with the Jeffries scale, but you see it in many papers. So everything where the odds ratio is more than 100-1 is decisive. Now, if we would Gaussianize this, this would say that everything beyond 3 sigma is decisive. Now, if you talk to people at CERN, they tell you the CERN has a sort of different situation in that the luminosity almost increases logarithmically. So some of the experimentalists said, well, 3 sigma effects last about a week. We're not so, we're not going to increase the Planck data by, it'll be a square root of 2 better nominally with the full data, although there'll be a lot more cross checks. So I don't know, I'm not a believer in this, but I have no alternative. I think the 5 sigma is one way to justify it, is that if you want to divide the data and do lots of consistency checks, you need something where you can you know, cut up in many ways. And if you have something like 2 sigma, well, you don't see anything when you try to divide. So there's very little you can do for systematic errors. But okay, I completely agree with you that you see this a lot. And, it's sort of, I put it in a spirit of sort of joking around, making people think. So let me go on to the sort of second part of my talk, which is more the future, and I'm going to be a bit prejudiced, and I'm not going to talk about all the great ground-based experiments that are underway. But basically, let me just go back to the first plot and just say something. So where can you really improve? I don't think that the error bar in this direction is going to, for decades, really improve all that much. Because, on the one hand, you have the size of the horizon, and things get really messy on small scales. So this will narrow a bit. But let me just point out, so this is R of about a tenth, just from the temperature and isotropy. And the claims are going to 10 to the minus 3 and less, et cetera. So basically, if you look at what people think they can do from space, if there's no R, we will be able to basically put the error bars almost on this horizontal line, and this just rule out everything. So this is really fantastic. If there aren't any showstoppers, like really nasty foregrounds, but there will be a lot of improvement in this area. And I also think that, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about sort of spin and testing inflation, et cetera. If we do see gravity waves, it's really an independent confirmation of a unique prediction of inflation. So in Europe, many of us who've worked on Planck have sort of in parallel been sort of thinking, well, what do we do after? And we've proposed so far three space missions detecting B modes. There are initiatives in the US, there's EPIC, CMB pole, there's Pixie, there's a Japanese Lightbird. So there are lots of ideas. And what I sort of want to do with maybe a little European bias, because that's what I know, sort of give you the outlines of what can be done, and how to do it, and the different options. So this is something we proposed in 2007 called BPOL. And here the basic idea was since the B modes, and I'll show this in a second, are on larger angular scales, you could sort of do a low cost and have a smaller telescope than Planck. So here there are these refracting telescopes, and you get the increased sensitivity from having a lot more detectors. And this was proposed by a coalition of people from basically all the European countries that participated in Planck. And ESA didn't like it that much because they said, failure is not an option, and if there are no B modes, we don't want to spend money on something that has a null result. The Japanese don't agree with ESA, and they're following Lightbird, which is, I would describe a bit as the design is quite different, but to have sort of a minimal mission to detect the B modes. So then, CLOR, which is this satellite here, was what was proposed 3 years later. And the big difference is to basically have a Planck size mirror, because the main cost factor is the size of the mirror, because it's expensive to have a big rocket and to try to do some more science. So this is sort of the basic name of the game. So we have the B modes, and here I'm assuming that they're low, so we sort of know the template of the B mode power spectrum very accurately. So this is these black lines, and they slide up and down because we don't really know what R, the tensor scalar ratio, is. And you can sort of see the perspective. Well, we have a log plot. This is the EE that Planck is really going to do quite well, that we're really pushing down. And in the linear theory, there are no B modes if there are no tensor degrees of freedom or vector degrees of freedom or nonlinearity. But we know that there's gravitational lensing, and we know what it is. It's been measured with Planck, but it also acts on the polarization, and you get something that just looks like instrument noise. So this is a white noise spectrum on large scales, so it's really boring, and then it sort of turns over, and this tells you the size of the lenses, so they're small. This is L is equal to 1,000. So for most experiments, the philosophy is, well, this is just like instrument noise. So you want, after you have enough power to subtract all the galactic crud away, you want to have a sensitivity that is sort of around here. If you go down farther, then it's just a waste of money. Now, there is this cleaning where you sort of try to predict the gravitational lensing, but you need to measure the lenses. So you need a really big mirror, and this is not the low cost. So this is sort of the basic philosophy. So CORE was, it's in the specifications, it's somewhat similar to the U.S. EPIC proposal that was from JPL. I think Jamie Bach was the PI. And here you have the sky, and there's this rotating half-wave plate, which I'll talk about some more, and a telescope in this focal plane. So the two elements that are important are, first of all, this rotating half-wave plate. So if you look at Planck, how the polarization analysis works, it's a bit of a mess, because you need to, you're basically making two measurements, ideally with the same beam, but you have to know the angles very accurately. If the beams are not the same, ellipticities convert quadrupole into polarization, and you get lots of spurious signals. So if you have this rotating half-wave plate, then I'll show this in more detail. Basically, this turns, and you look for the signal at four times this frequency. So you can have not so good optics and not so good detectors and so on, and all the systematic errors go away when you use this modulation. So this is slightly over a meter. It has to be cooled. And this is hard to do, and this was one of the worries. Okay, let's go to the focal plane. So this is a Planck focal plane with 72 detectors, and the HFI is here. This is the LFI. And these detectors are pretty much at the quantum noise limit. So basically, the only way to improve the situation is to have more detectors. So here is the focal plane of CORE with 7,000 detectors. And this is really not so science fiction anymore, because if you look at ACPOL, SPTPOL, well, the sort of mass production of detectors is has become reality on the ground. This is just a slide doing the quantum noise, but this is the limit that you don't have enough photons. This is like wires, and this puts in a phase shift. So that this was the CORE modulation. I'm going to just not go through this in detail, but the signal has this higher frequency. So this the bands have to be sort of tuned to this difference in path length. So that places some rejection, some restrictions on how to design your bands. And here's some tables. I could say more on this, but I'll sort of skip ahead. Okay, this is Planck and this is CORE. And you can see that, mainly for the number of detectors, but also you have to reject systematic errors at the same level. You really push down, and here you can see, I think we were 10 to the minus 3 at 3 sigma, and this is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, I would say, of inflationary models. There's a lot of discussion about, well, what is the value of R predicted? But this would have been the error circles of CORE. There's a lot of science with lensing, because lensing is much easier with polarization, because there's really no cosmic variance, because there shouldn't be any B modes. That is assuming that they're none from inflation. So this shows with the temperature and how much better you do with the polarization. And this is sort of something this was somewhat marginal, but detecting distinguishing the normal from inverted hierarchy, measuring absolute neutrino masses. So this was one of the things that you could do with CORE. Then there's also a lot of galactic science, looking at dust polarization in diffuse regions. Yes? Sort of around the same order of magnitude. The advantage that you have with the CMB is it's farther away, so the lenses are farther away and you're closer to the linear theory. CORE didn't get approved, so we're talking about there's competition between the two. You can also, the dust is on the one hand something nasty that has to be subtracted, but it also tells you a lot about magnetic fields, mainly for star formation. And there would be an important contribution from this. This is a list of all the foregrounds. I'm going to skip ahead because I want to talk about prism. And let me just, these are foreground simulations that people have done, sort of with reasonable extrapolations of the foregrounds, well, just before the Planck data. This hasn't been redone. And the thing to take away is that whereas with the temperature and isotropy, you're just sort of cleaning something that's pretty clean, you mainly see foregrounds, and you really need to understand them to very aggressively subtract them away. Let's see. Let me just show. This is EPIC, which is they basically rotate the satellite and have a very complicated scanning strategy to try to deal with or cancel systematic errors rather than the rotating wave plate. But in terms of the number of detectors, it's quite similar. PIXI is another very interesting initiative that basically takes FIRAS in a 2-degree beam, and they also can do polarization. Now they're going to get the absolute spectrum of the CMB, and basically this instrument rotates. And I'll show you a little more about this when I talk about PRISM, because PRISM wants to have a spectrometer like this. This has four detectors, and the reason that there are four is it's multi-mode, so you get thousands of modes, and the cost is that you don't get all this extra science at high resolution. This is a Japanese light bird, which is sort of a little like the Beeple philosophy. Let's have something simple that will just detect B modes, but not expect the most complicated foreground. So PRISM, okay, we chose this name a couple months ago, and things have happened since then. So this is the sort of competing PRISM project with all this flow of information. And no, we're competing. And since I prepared the talk in Europe, I had to sort of emphasize the European participation. So this is the UK Spy Center. So this is our PRISM that will just look at the sky and not you. So what happened in Europe is that there's a competition for large-scale missions. So there are two slots, and there was a lot of debate, should we try to do this? So, and people said, well, why not? Let's think of all the other stuff that one could do if one had a really large mirror and cooling and also an FDS spectrometer. So I'm going to sort of rush through this and tell you a little about what is new things you can do. So a lot of the things are, there are two instruments. There's a spectrometer, which is a little like PIXI. So this compares the sky to an artificial black body. So you're not just looking at differences in temperature in the sky. But this has this actually has a smaller resolution than PIXI, but not that much. I think 1.5 degrees or something. And here you have a 3.5 meter mirror, so this is diffraction limited. And with the increased budget, one can cool the mirror to 4 Kelvin. So why would you want to do that? Well, the reason is that if you want to do astronomy into the far infrared, the sky is really dark. you're in the Wien part of the spectrum. So just having a very high reflectivity mirror isn't enough. The optics are the major contaminant. So you get 100 times better sensitivity in the non-CMB channels. So I'm going to, this is sort of an overview of the two instruments. And I'm just going to tell you about the stuff, the new science that you can do with this. There are lots of spectral lines that become a problem. You probably are aware that CO was not good for Planck and that we did not choose our channels well. Then there are also channels that go up to 6 terahertz. So this is just for other science, mainly infrared galaxies. So let me explain to you the spectrometer. And this is like a modern version of FIRES. So you have these beam splitters with wires. And I won't go through the details, but there's a sort of corner, right angle corner mirror that slides back and forth. And basically the beam is being steered between seeing one polarization on the perfect black body, artificial, in the sky. And this gives you the Fourier spectrum of the difference of the Fourier transform of the spectrum with respect to this black body. So this is an absolute measurement. And one of the things that's unique about PRISM is that this can be used to calibrate the 3.5 meter mirror instrument with an exquisite angular resolution limited by diffraction. And then you can also subtract sort of crud like Sunyaev-Saldovich clusters from this and do the spectral science better. So the new science, one of the things is basically finding a million clusters. So eRosita will get, which is an X-ray sky telescope, will be the best survey at the time PRISM flies if it's approved, but it only goes to about redshift of 1, whereas basically here PRISM goes all the way. I mean, this is, well, you should sort of look here. You go to sort of redshift 3, almost 4, and there are lots of clusters. So this sort of gets the evolution. And if you compare to Euclid, well, it's not just getting clusters, it's the quality of your catalog. So Sunyaev-Saldovich, when you have a marginal detection, is most closely correlated with mass. Optical clusters with richness, there are lots of false detections, and it's a very large scatter. So this is a much higher quality. There's less scatter than with X-ray catalogs, but X-rays, if you have exquisite resolution and lots of signal to noise for the really close clusters, you can really map out the temperature and do better. So they're complementary. You can get the temperature from the relativistic Sunyaev-Saldovich effect. So this is because of the electrons are not at a small thermal velocity compared to the velocity of light. And you can also do the kinetic Sunyaev-Saldovich effect, which allows you to get peculiar velocities. So that this is because of the good angular resolution in large part because there's not much CMB anisotropy, so you can subtract that away. Then let me show you. This is the sun, and The photosphere is where the photons come from, so you only see a very thin layer. So we can ask, how much time do I have? Okay. You see the photon number goes much, number of photons is determined at about redshift of 10 to the 6. So you can see all sorts of stuff, decaying dark matter, the power spectrum on small scales. Let me just go to the summary slide. So this is sort of the sensitivity to the spectrum. And then these are all the different signals. We can't quite see the recombination line. So this would be new science with a spectrometer. So let's see. Since I'm running out of time, I'll just go to the conclusion. So this is the these are the characters behind these two missions. This is the guy who testified before the U.S. Congress defending what they were doing. And this is our friend Paolo, whom most of you know. And I guess my conclusion would be the NSA wants to know everything about you. I mean, they're building data centers to stack the web for, 100 years. And we want to find out everything about the universe in this frequency range. So we want to capture all available signals. So with this large class mission, we would almost do this. The real limitation is that the size of the mirror, 3.5 meters, is about the limit of what you can put on a spaceship in the budget. Now, let me just, this is our website. And it's really important, and this is not just from people from Europe, to the other competing missions have made this list of supporters, and they have like 1,000 names, and we're a little over 500 because we started really late. If you want this to happen, please, sign up and become a supporter of this. So this will be presented, and PRISM will be presented in September, and there should be a decision for the themes for the two ESA large class missions, sort of end of the year. So if not, we would repropose CORE improved in about a year, and who knows what's going to happen. There are great projects in Japan and the U.S., and I think people will work together, but I think this is something that, there's just so much potential, both for learning something new about inflation in the very early universe, and also, a lot of exciting science with the spectrum that if you go three orders of magnitude beyond Fi-Res, there's a great potential for surprises. And it's sort of interesting that for this absolute spectrum, it's still COBE that is the best. And we've just, as a community, gone after the anisotropies, but there are other things to do. And I didn't talk about infrared galaxies and the far infrared, cosmic infrared background, but that's another thing that's very exciting. So thank you.
Questions? So what's the best improvement for inflation? So I saw you had one plot where the error bars for in the RNS plane, it looked like the error bars in NS had actually shrunken a lot compared to the Planck results. But you had said that any foreseeable mission wouldn't really do a lot to shrink the error bars. So was the scale just different on the horizontal axis, or is there an actual big improvement on NS that would come with, say, core?
Well, I was referring to NS.
Yeah, but the NS error bars looked like they were a lot tighter. Was that just a byproduct of the scale on the plot?
Well, Planck goes a lot beyond WMAP because there are two reasons. So, first of all, they're bolometric detectors, which are a lot more sensitive. And then the second improvement is angular resolution. So all these experiments are at the diffraction limit. So if you go to about twice the frequency, so 217 gigahertz is sort of the last CMB channel, then you get basically a factor of 2 in K just from the resolution, but it's actually a bit more because you have more sensitivity, so there's less noise. So that's a way to understand that. So then you could ask, oh, well, why not, use something like ACT, which goes to L is equal to 10,000. Well, the reason you can't do that is that around L is equal to 3,000, you start the primordial anisotropies as a sideshow. So the lensing is the main thing you see in the temperature. You see all these Sunyaev-Seldovich, effect. Anything small peaks at large L, so you can't push very far. Now, with ACT-POL and SPT-POL, actually the foregrounds are not so polarized, so they're going to be able to push farther up in L with probing the power spectrum, but you're not going to be. Maybe other people know the predictions better, but you're not going to push orders of magnitude as you can with the B modes and measuring R, which is basically just increasing the sensitivity without going to smaller scales.
A question to that. What's the ultimate limit from the CMB if you can also use spectral distortions in the, I mean, will then you be able to do better in NS because you can probe higher K?
Okay. Let's see. You can go, so this is what you sort of see with the CMB. And here you can't go to smaller scales because the limit is what comes into the horizon at redshift of about a million. So you get this sort of chemical potential here, which is mu distortion from the silk damping. And that's basically the photons can't change their number, but they redistribute their energy because there's enough recoil from Thomson scattering. So that's what goes on. Then if you go later, the redistribution in energy is partial. We could write some integral kernel and, if there weren't any noise and other stuff, completely reproduce the spectrum, but it's probably a few numbers. So let's just put in perspective, if you just increase the power law, well, you would have this silk damping spectrum, so you would get a significant detection subject, getting rid of all of this crud, the reionization which you know is there, has to be subtracted away. I don't know if you could do a lot better than and move down an order of magnitude, perhaps you could do even better. Now, one question that this would be a bit ambiguous, because decaying dark matter, for example, also gives mu distortions and other distortions. So you'll see something, but I don't think it's going to have a completely unambiguous interpretation. But this is something good. There's been much less work on how to do this realistically than compared to, you know, foreground removal for anisotropies, where the limitation is not people's work, but basically that one is extrapolating models with a certain amount of faith that things that aren't too bad aren't going to sort of pop up beyond the horizon, where this is sort of more unexplored territory.
I guess you probably said this, but I missed it a little bit. I mean, it would be very interesting to know about polarization in the very low L's, partly because of these anomalies in the temperature maps. And, well, I think also for theoretical reasons, the very low L's are very interesting. So, you know, let's say L less than like 20 or something. What are the prospects for detection there?
Well, I think with understanding the anomalies, Planck is going to do quite well, because if you believe the sort of standard simple model, and you know, well, maybe it's changed a bit by the anomalies, the E-mode signal will be very large, so Planck should do very well with the E-mode signal. So you don't really need these fantastic experiments to do that, that you would do that with the Planck data. The reason why you really need to push is, well, T over S is roughly the percentage of, you know, Planck. So, you know, you need, if you go to T over S is 0.1, well, 10 times the sensitivity is 100 times the detectors, if you sort of make a back of the envelope calculation. So you really need to push very hard for these other signals. But for a large range of the EE spectrum in the maps, they should be cosmic variance limited.
But I mean, T over S could have some feature at low L, potentially. Right, I mean, if there's scale invariant T over S, then yeah. But it might be well motivated that you know, there's more tensor power at low L, for example.
What I didn't talk about was that if you have things like cosmic strings, you also get a different signal. Your point is that there could be surprises, that maybe what is making the cold spot has nothing to do with linear theory, and maybe it would give you B modes. So my expectation would be that we would see those with Planck, but there's no theory, so that's a bit a guess.
Right, well, thank you very much, man.